The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Hank Greenberg, the 122nd president of the New York State Bar Association. Greenberg concentrates his practice on civil litigation, criminal and civil investigations, and regulatory and administrative law. He's a former counsel to then New York State Attorney General, now Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, general counsel for the New York State Department of Health, and a federal prosecutor. Among other government posts, he also served as law clerk to the then associate judge, later chief judge, Judith S. K. of the New York Court of Appeals. You can find out more about the Bar Association at nysba.org, nysba.org. Welcome, Hank.
Good morning, Alan. How are you?
What an impressive background you've had.
Thank you.
Where'd you go to law school?
Syracuse.
Oh, yeah? Do you like it?
Loved it.
Oh,
loved
good.
It.
And you grew up where?
The old Borscht Belt, Sullivan County.
No kidding.
Small town, South Fallsburg.
What did your parents do?
My father was an attorney. My mother was a homemaker. And it was an interesting place to grow up at an interesting time in New York State.
Yeah. Big Boy Scout camp there, isn't there?
There was, but what was really known for when I was a kid were the hotels.
Well, the hotels, of course. Okay, well, listen, you got a big job. You're the head of the Bar Association, so I guess I got to ask you, what's on your plate?
Well, we have a series of task forces that we've established that are studying issues that I think will be of great interest to policymakers.
And to lawyers.
And to lawyers. What we try to do, we were established by the New York State Legislature in 1877. And one of our missions, our core mission, is to try to advance public policy issues that are of great importance to the profession and to the public and to do the public good. So four of our task forces are looking at issues that blue ribbon commissions that I think will come up with proposals that will be useful to policymakers, for example. Throughout the state, and actually the nation, this is a problem. Local journalism, particularly print media, is struggling. In parts of broad swaths of New York, most of New York actually in terms of geography is rural. 87% of the state is in rural communities. Papers in smaller cities, Rochester, Buffalo, Syracuse, to a certain extent even the Times Union in Albany, are struggling. The digital revolution, print digital advertising is making it harder and harder for local media to, you know, fill out newsrooms. So you might ask, what do lawyers care about that? And the answer is lawyers care a lot, because at the end of the day, free expression, the First Amendment, in order for it to flourish, you need a robust media. And when you have, for example, communities like Syracuse, the Post Standard is also only producing print newspapers 3 days a week. Or I was in Buffalo just a few weeks ago doing an editorial board meeting with the great Buffalo News, one of the great papers in the country. The newsroom was empty. So we've assembled a task force. The Deputy General Counsel of the New York Times, David McCraw, is one of its co-chairs. And they're doing a deep dive into this issue, and they'll be proposing various things that policymakers can look at to hopefully solve the problem.
So you got a couple of hints as to what may come out of this?
Well, it's interesting, right? Let me give you an example. We have a Freedom of Information Law, FOIL, which allows members of the public and news gathering organizations to request documents and records from state agencies that are relevant to how our government operates. If a state agency denies a FOIL request, well, then the person who made the request can go to court. They can bring a lawsuit. That costs money. So, for example, if you're a reporter and you submit a FOIL request and a state agency, let's just say hypothetically, denies the request for no good reason at all, yeah, you can bring a lawsuit. But for a small newspaper in a smaller community, that costs money. And they have to go out and they have to hire a lawyer. So sort of looking at an issue like that, or alternatively, if a small news gathering organization is sued based on an allegation of slander or defamation, that costs money to defend themselves. So sort of looking at those legal regimes and trying to find ways to assist local newspapers, that's one of the things we're going to be looking at. Let me give you another example of the kinds of things we're focusing on. I mentioned before how many parts of the state, 3.5 million New Yorkers live in rural communities. 87% of the state is in rural communities. We're experiencing in many of these communities a justice crisis. Why? Because there are fewer and fewer lawyers that are willing to make their lives in these communities. Let me give you an example. More than half of the lawyers who practice in rural communities are at or near retirement age. Younger lawyers graduating law schools with huge debt, college and law school debt, find it more and more difficult to make a life or a living, so they're not replacing the older lawyers that are retiring. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is that the rights, the freedoms, the citizenry takes for granted, they amount to nothing unless there are lawyers prepared to champion them and courts and judges that will enforce them.
So what are some of the ways around that dilemma?
Well, the task force is studying that, and I don't want to prejudge where they'll come out, but let me give you a few examples of some of the problems. Here are two. One is that for many of these communities, and these are economically depressed communities in many instances, lawyers represent indigent populations. They are unable to pay their legal fees. The state, in criminal cases, for example, is obliged to pay those fees. There is a rate established by the state for those fees. That rate hasn't changed since 2004. So, for example, if someone in the Adirondacks in a small community is charged with a felony, they have a right to counsel, and a lawyer can be engaged, and their fees will be paid at a rate of $65 an hour. So for a felony criminal case, there is a cap on the amount of money that the lawyer can receive, a few thousand dollars at the end of the day.
So we wouldn't be terribly, Hank, we wouldn't be terribly surprised to see this task force come up with a recommendation that these lawyers be paid more money. But that would be seen as somewhat self-serving for a lawyer-inspired committee, wouldn't it?
It shouldn't be. And here's why. Those rates haven't changed since 2004. At the end of the day, we all have an interest in the right to counsel, the constitutional right to counsel, to be meaningful. If the rates are so low that no one can make a living receiving those rates, and attorneys will not move and spend their lives and careers in rural communities, and there are no lawyers to protect the citizenry, that's a problem. We all have an interest in that. But let me give you another example of another problem in these communities, broadband access. Increasingly, like the rest of society, the practice of law is becoming dependent on technology. Courts now are receiving briefs and memos from lawyers that are filed electronically. If you're living in a community where there's no access to the internet, so if you're living in a community that doesn't have broadband access,
yes,
that makes it challenging and difficult to practice law. So that's another task force that will be looking at those issues and making recommendations. Another area we're looking at, Alan, is the parole system. I think there is a broad-based belief, close to a consensus, that the reform system is in need of reforms, or the parole system is in need of reforms.
Got it.
I'll give you one example. 1/3 every year of the persons who are incarcerated in New York State are incarcerated for technical violations of the terms of parole, the conditions under which they are released from prison. So, for example, people are reincarcerated because they had a beer when the terms and conditions didn't allow them to have alcohol, or they failed to meet a parole officer. So of the 20,000 plus persons every year who are incarcerated, 1/3 for technical violations. That's an enormous cost to the state. And in many instances, I think reasonable people would look at that and say that for a minor infraction, a person should not be returned to prison. Law and order states, or states that view themselves as very aggressive in the law and order world, Florida, Texas, they've managed to address this issue. The legislature, our state legislature last year, debated these issues, but ultimately wasn't able to come to consensus.
Do we know why?
Well, they had a lot on their plate last year. It was the legislature was very productive. They did some important work in the area, criminal justice area, in terms of criminal discovery. But the clock ran out, and they weren't able to get to parole as an issue. You know, so what we have done, and there is, you know, amount of political controversy surrounding certain aspects of parole. It's not an issue that has a natural political constituency that bangs the table, clamoring a reform. Yet good government groups and I think thoughtful people look at the system and say changes should be made.
But they're not politicians who are in the Department of Self-Serving, as we just mentioned.
Well, here's how we're trying to be helpful. We've assembled a task force that is diverse in every way, but most especially ideologically diverse. Prosecutors, defense lawyers, academics, victims' rights advocates, civil legal services providers, judges from throughout the state, upstate, downstate, Republican, Democrat. And the idea is for this group, when it will achieve consensus, and it will come up with proposals for the legislature, I think the legislature will be able to look at it and understand that a broad swath of the community, of our state, that are concerned about these issues, left and right, north and south, have come to consensus, and that there is safe ground to support these proposals.
Yeah, but we're talking about legislators who, you know, don't want to be labeled soft on crime.
And one of the reasons why we have tried to create a group that includes elected district attorneys, David Soares, the district attorney of Albany County, Eric Gonzalez, the district attorney in the Bronx, by putting prosecutors on this group, judges, conservatives, as well as moderates and liberals, policymakers can look at its recommendations and understand that this is a consensus approach to the problem and hopefully will help advance the discussion.
Okay, so I want to talk to you a little bit about cannabis. You've got a group on that.
It's another area that we know the legislature is interested in. There was a lot of debate the last legislative session. New York passed laws that decriminalized marijuana last year, although recreational use, while it was debated last year, the legislature did not act on those proposals. So we know in this coming session, there's an indication that the legislature will again debate, discuss, and consider whether New York, like other states, should legalize marijuana for recreational use. So we have a cannabis committee that is studying that issue, looking at all the various issues surrounding it, and will be coming up with a proposal. And once again, I don't want to prejudge where they will land on that issue. But it's another example of how the organized bar wants to look at an important public policy issue that is of interest to lawyers as well and make a proposal, thoughtful, substantive, based on principle. And we bring something to the table that I think is important and in a way unique, I think, for policymakers when they view our work product. We are ideologically diverse. We are Republican and Democrat, men and women, gay and straight. Lawyers represent and reflect our entire community. For our association to come to consensus on an issue necessarily reflects that we were able to bring together a diverse group and population of people that have come together with a proposal that policymakers can look at, not as an expression of a special pleader's viewpoint, but rather the product of an organization over 140,000 years old, pursuing the highest and noblest traditions of the most influential and, in my judgment, consequential profession in American life. So when we make a proposal, cannabis is one example, policymakers will know it is not a reflection or an expression of some deep-seated ideological viewpoint that they can guess what it will be. It is our best judgment about what the right answer is.
You worked for Governor Cuomo, didn't you?
I did.
So how do we know that the game isn't loaded? I mean, he has specific interests. I've talked to him many, many times about marijuana. And in the beginning, he was opposed. Then when things moved left, he started being, how do I know he hasn't called in the play with you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm telling you, he hasn't. I have
and
surely...
that you're not following what you think he wants you to do.
Yeah, well, I've not spoken to him. I have not spoken to a member of his administration about this issue. I haven't come within a million miles of them. And it's not my opinion or judgment that is going to dictate the outcome of our recommendation.
Well, haven't you ever heard of the iron law of oligarchy in which somebody sitting at the top calls the shots? And that's you. You're sitting at the top.
Well, we're talking about lawyers, you know, two lawyers, three opinions.
Yeah.
So the notion that I, as president for a single year, could persuade a fiercely independent committee of where they should land on an issue like this is...
Let me ask you about this, because in the old days when I was a young political scientist, we used to talk about the dominance of lawyers in the legislature. Is that still true?
In fewer numbers than it's been in the past. I think ultimately we've suffered because of it.
What does that mean?
Let me answer the question first from a historical perspective.
Sure.
The institutions that have kept us free for over 200 years were built by lawyers. The Constitution of the United States was written by lawyers. The Constitution of the State of New York was written by lawyers. Lawyers, by disposition and training, are inclined to try to find a middle ground, understand what compromise is, has a unique ability to bring people who can't agree on anything and come to the table and find common ground. Lawyers know how to debate without being disagreeable or divisive. That the legislature today, as compared to 50 years ago, has few lawyers, I think when you look at Congress in particular, what you see is an organization that's less capable of achieving compromise. You go to law school, you learn about the ability to find common ground and bring people together. So I think more lawyers in the legislature would serve the legislature well. After all, these are laws we're talking about. Lawyers are trained and taught how to interpret law, how to write law, how to construe law. So from my perspective, the more lawyers you have in the legislature, the better.
Well, there would be those who disagree with you, of course, on that issue, think that, you know, a legislature should be more of the people than of a specific group of people.
Well, let's look at the group that wrote the United States Constitution. Two-thirds of them were lawyers. Madison, Hamilton were lawyers.
Yeah.
Don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that we don't want a legislature that's broadly representative of the population and all the various walks of life and professions. But I think lawyers bring unique gifts and skills that are useful to the legislature and to the position of being a legislator.
There are those people who think that the emergence of Donald Trump has affected all of our politics. As a lawyer, I'm sure you don't want to get into this, but as a lawyer and as a New York State lawyer who has watched our politics, is that true?
Well, I'll respond to your question this way. Setting aside the personality, the current incumbent in the White House.
Impossible.
Well, we can agree on this, I think, right? All of us should be deeply concerned about the polarization and the tribalization in our society. All of us should be deeply concerned when we see public discourse turning into a blood sport. All of us should be concerned when any elected official or so-called leader mocks the principles our founding fathers held self-evident. All of us should also be concerned when we see in growing numbers the public losing confidence in the ability of institutions, the institution lawyers built, to solve problems. That's why, in my judgment, the voice of lawyers and the legal profession is needed today more so than ever, at least in my 57 years.
Because he's president?
Not because he's president. I think many of the problems that I just sort of articulated cannot be attributed to one individual.
Well, he's not a lawyer.
Yes, that's true. And when I think of...
Would we be better off if he was a lawyer?
Well, Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer, and Franklin Roosevelt was a lawyer, and many of
Harry Truman was, and he was a great president.
He was. I happen to think our greatest presidents were lawyers, not because they were lawyers, but it certainly influenced, informed, and made them, at least in part, thoughtful and deep thinkers, Lincoln, Roosevelt, and others.
Now, we have a series of law schools in the country, in New York State, and then we have these, you know, white shoe, white glove, whatever you want to call them, law firms, which hire basically from Harvard and Yale and some of these other places. Is New York holding its own in law schools?
We have an extraordinary collection. We have 15 law schools in New York State that are producing the best and the brightest young lawyers in the state, all throughout the state, from the western part of the state, SUNY Buffalo, Central New York, Syracuse Law School, Long Island, Manhattan. We have, amongst 50 states of the nation, a very powerful collection of law schools that are doing extraordinary work.
Now, I know one of the task forces you're interested in is diversity. Mario Cuomo, who I interviewed for many, many years, was pretty ticked off about the fact that he couldn't get one of these elite law firms to interview him based on the fact that, you know, he's Italian, let's face it. And now we have seen the big issue with Chris Cuomo being called Fredo and Andrew Cuomo getting very upset about that and saying that this the remnants of all of this, you know, anti-diversity stuff are still around. So I'm going to ask you, what do you expect this group to come up with?
Well, first of all, I think what Governor Cuomo, the first Governor Cuomo experienced, that kind of prejudice directed towards, in his case, Italian-Americans, I think Jews experienced that as well in some segments of the legal profession in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. That has fallen away. Thank goodness for that. I don't think you see, at least amongst white shoe law firms, discrimination of that kind. But what we continue to see, which is deeply troubling, is that the legal profession remains, at least amongst all of the professions, one of the least diverse. That's a problem that needs to be fixed.
How do you do that? Queens set up a free law school, right?
Right.
So that's one way to do it.
Well, one way you do it is to lead by example. You know the Nike slogan, just do it?
Yeah.
Well, diversity like that is an act of will. Let me give you an example, at least, of what we've done at the State Bar Association this year. We have over 50 standing committees. The President of the State Bar Association doesn't really have a lot of power, but does have the power to appoint members of the committee.
Sounds like a lot of power.
There we go. Well, what we've done this year is that every one of our standing committees, more than 50 of them, has a chair, a co-chair, or a vice chair, is a woman, a person of color, or otherwise diverse. So we are leading by example. And we as an association, and myself in particular, using the bully pulpit every way we can to encourage lawyers, law firms, policymakers who appoint judges, the courts, every sphere in which lawyers practice to diversify.
Why? So are you satisfied, based on what you're saying now, with the major law firms doing other than tokenism? In other words, really integrating their workforce?
No, I'm not satisfied. We need, as I said before, law firms, but not just law firms, every sphere of the profession needs to diversify. Needs to do a better job, needs to think about it. And why? Why is it so important? In my judgment, by the way, I not only think it's important, I think it's a moral imperative. We're New Yorkers. We live in New York. This is where the Statue of Liberty rests in New York Harbor. We are amongst, if not the most diverse state in the nation. Men and women, gay and straight. Every religion is practiced in New York. Every language is spoken in New York. Our profession needs to be as diverse as the clients we represent. It is amongst the most important.
But it's not.
It is not, and it's
because
because is the same. The answer to that question, I think, is the same answer that we as a society are grappling with, right? Part of it is cultural. Part of it is structural. At the end of the day, though, the only way we meaningfully address this problem is first recognize that we have a problem, talk about it, and then, as I said before, make a commitment every day in every way we can to try to diversify our profession. Especially as New Yorkers, it's an imperative that we do it, and I think it's a moral imperative.
Okay, so tell us what happens now, Hank Greenberg, when these committees report to you. What happens with that information, with those results?
When a committee or task force of the association makes a series of recommendations, usually in a written report, it goes to our policy-making body, the House of Delegates, which consists of over 200 lawyers from around the state. The House then deliberates over whether to approve the report. When the report is approved, we do our best to advocate for its recommendations with policymakers in the legislature, the executive branch. And many of the task forces that I described, we're hopeful that they will be producing reports in time to bring to the legislature when it convenes in January of this year. And we use our best efforts to promote those recommendations using opportunities like the one we're grateful to you're providing for us today to let the public and thought leaders know what we're thinking.
Do you think, and I just want to end with this, but it's a big subject. The legislature has just been taken over the Senate by Democrats. And the Republicans, who did have a relationship with your old boss, Andrew Cuomo, have exited. Do you think that there is a potential separation now between the governor and the legislature that maybe did not exist before, that there is some tension there?
Well, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a political scientist, and I'm not a political commentator.
Both of which I am, I take it you mean. Yeah. Well,
but I will say, as a citizen, it was great to see last legislative session, the legislature and the governor working so well together and passing so many laws in areas that in years past they weren't able to come to consensus on.
That's true, but I think I sense some tension there, too, between Speaker Hastie and Leader Cousins following through on the way that this is all working. I suspect we're going to see some real fireworks here. Yeah.
Well,
let us know that Hank Greenberg is nodding but not saying anything.
I will tell you this, though. As a New Yorker,
yeah,
I am pleased and proud to see a state government that is working, functional, looking at problems, debating them, and trying to solve them.
I'm with you on that. We are so grateful to you, Hank, for coming in and talking to us. We don't have enough discussion on this level of the way in which the legal profession is working. We're out of time. Our guest has been Hank Greenberg, president of the New York State Bar Association. You can find out more at nysba.org, nysba.org. Hank, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Alan.